EU leaders gather to consider Ukraine's membership bid. Plus, US-China shipping prices slide. And Sri Lanka's prime minister warns of economic collapse.
It's kind of dysfunction and despair at every turn. Daily rolling power outages, inconsistent fuel supply, hospitals are short of drugs and medical supplies, and food prices are through the roof.
It's Thursday, June 23rd. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. European Union leaders will kick off a summit in Brussels today, in which they are likely to invite Ukraine and neighbor Moldova to begin the protracted process of becoming members. The 27 leaders will also debate potential responses to soaring fuel and grocery bills in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Additional summits featuring members of the Group of Seven leading economies and NATO are scheduled in the coming days. Meanwhile, the German government moved closer to rationing natural gas on Thursday, triggering the second of its three-step plan to deal with gas shortages after Russia cut deliveries to the country last week. Economy Minister Robert Habeck says he now expects a gas shortage by December if supplies don't pick up. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is investigating a new report of another child's death after consuming Abbott Laboratories' baby formula, the agency said Wednesday. The FDA said the child died in January, and it received a report of the death earlier this month from a consumer's complaint. Disclosure of the investigation is likely to intensify scrutiny of Abbott, one of the leading sellers of baby formula in the U.S. An Abbott spokesman said, at this time, there is no evidence to suggest a causal relationship between Abbott's formulas and this newly reported case. In Washington, the U.S. House committee investigating the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol will hold its fifth hearing today. The hearing is expected to highlight former President Donald Trump's efforts to enlist senior Justice Department officials, including his acting attorney general, into a wide-ranging effort to overturn the 2020 presidential election. Trump has denied wrongdoing connected to the Capitol riot. We are exclusively reporting that Facebook parent company Meta said Wednesday it has canceled its sponsorship agreement with the organization planning the federal government's commemoration of the 250th anniversary of the U.S. The project has been beset by internal strife and is facing a discrimination lawsuit filed by female former executives. The chairman of both the Semiquincentennial Commission and the America 250 Foundation, Daniel DeLella, didn't immediately respond to a request for comment, but a foundation spokesman said the organization, quote, remains confident that it will be working with Meta in the future. And companies in China are cutting back on digital ad spending as the economy slows and recurring COVID-19 outbreaks weigh on consumption. Businesses in China spent about 20% less on all forms of advertising in April compared to the same month a year ago, according to CTR Market Research. Shares of Chinese shipping companies have fallen in Hong Kong, following the U.S. Federal Reserve's overnight warning of a potential economic contraction, which could weigh on U.S. demand for imported goods and consequently global shipping activity. Meanwhile, shipping prices have cooled in recent months, with the cost of shipping a container from China to the U.S. last week standing at just over $9,500. That is according to the Freightos Baltic Index and represents a drop of 34% since the start of the year and 50% from a year earlier. We are joined now by WSJ senior reporter Kostas Paris, who covers global shipping and logistics for us. Hi, Kostas.
Hi. Good to be with you.
So why is it that these shipping rates are down since the start of 2022?
What's driving it down is a drop in demand from the American consumer, so from retail chains. It's also that we're still at the beginning of the peak period in shipping, so not too many orders have come in yet, and that's the two main reasons. So we do not expect to return to a peak of 20 or 25,000 for a box across the Pacific, but we do not expect also a drop to pre-pandemic levels, which I think was 2,000-3,000 per container.
And Kostas, finally, I wonder, is a reduction in U.S.-China shipping volume maybe leading to some alleviation of the backups that many U.S. ports have been dealing with in recent months?
It is certainly a good thing. They have managed the Port of Los Angeles to push out during this lull period and the fewer ships, thousands of containers out. The problem is that in order for a port not to be congested, whatever is unloaded for ships has to move in. And the first point of call from the containers being unloaded to the Port of Los Angeles is a complex of warehouses in Southern California. These warehouses are 99.7% full, which means there's little space to take in the containers from the ports. The other thing is that around 40% of the containers are supposed to be moved by rail inland to big distribution points like Chicago. Only half of them are being moved lately over the past few months because there's a shortage of labor. Because the rail companies furloughed a number of their drivers during COVID and they have trouble bringing them back. This is what's slowing down cargo and deliveries.
That was Wall Street Journal senior reporter Kostas Paris. Kostas, thanks as always.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, we'll get an update on the economic crisis unfolding in Sri Lanka and look at whether it's a warning signal for other countries in the developing world. That story after the break.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Yesterday, the Prime Minister of Sri Lanka announced that after months of double-digit inflation, acute shortages, and rolling power blackouts, the country's indebted economy faced, quote, a complete collapse. WSJ South Asia correspondent Philip Wen is in New Delhi, and he joins us now with the latest on the crisis in Sri Lanka. Philip, thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Could you walk us through what is happening in Sri Lanka currently, economically, politically, and otherwise?
Yeah, so Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe's characterization would be self-evident to each of Sri Lanka's 22 million people who have been living through this economic crisis. To live in Sri Lanka now is to endure daily rolling power outages of more than 10 hours a day. There's inconsistent fuel supply, so you have to queue at the gas station to get petrol or kerosene for hours or even days, depending where you are. Local media reports have tallied 11 deaths of people waiting in line since late April. There are similar shortages of kerosene and cooking gas and other basic essentials. Authorities have shut schools down and non-essential government services to save power. Hospitals are short of drugs and medical supplies. And food prices are through the roof. You know, food inflation hit 57% last month. And that's across a basket of goods. Basic staples like rice, by all accounts, have tripled since the start of the year. In fact, that may already be out of date as we speak, because everyone there says they're greeted with new inflated price tags every time they visit their local store. On top of all this, you've got political turmoil and anti-government protests that have turned violent at times. So it's kind of dysfunction and despair at every turn.
What is the origin of this crisis, if we can put our finger on it?
So the reason for all this, in short, is that the government has run out of money. Its foreign reserves, namely US dollars, have been all but entirely bled dry. So it can't afford to pay for essential imports like fuel. It suspended repayments of external debt, which amounts to some $35 billion in April, and it formally defaulted last month. The most immediate thing that tipped Sri Lanka over the edge was the impact of the coronavirus pandemic and soaring inflation globally. So like most countries, Sri Lanka was hit hard economically by the pandemic, but especially so because it's heavily reliant on its tourism sector for foreign currency earnings. But for Sri Lanka's financial position to have been fragile enough to be at that breaking point, it certainly didn't happen overnight. It stems from when Mahinda Rajapaksa, the former prime minister, was president a bit over a decade ago. This was a time when his government had been borrowing heavily, including from China, to build out these kinds of ambitious nation-building type infrastructure projects across the country, like roads and ports and airports, convention centres, cricket stadiums, you name it. The problem was they didn't all generate any semblance of a good commercial return, and they were sort of forced to increasingly turn to on-market borrowings through international sovereign bonds to repay and roll over their existing debt. So this debt continued to snowball over the years, but when they passed sweeping tax cuts in 2019 as part of an election promise, that really drained the government revenue base and prompted credit rating agencies to downgrade their credit ratings to the point where they could no longer access that market borrowing. And that's where things really came to a head.
Philip, what is being done to try and navigate Sri Lanka out of this crisis? And what is the likelihood these measures are going to be enough?
So Sri Lanka is in talk with the International Monetary Fund for a possible financial bailout. And IMF delegation is in Colombo, the Sri Lankan capital, as we speak. The key condition for anything to happen, though, is for Sri Lanka to first restructure its debt with its various external creditors to show that it can regain a sustainable economic footing. Those creditors include holders of its sovereign bonds and multilateral institutions, but also bilateral creditors, including Japan, China, and India. So that's going to be by no means a straightforward negotiation process. In the longer run, in terms of economic reforms that have been foreshadowed by Wickremesinghe, he's alluded to a range of tough austerity measures, you know, including reversing previous tax cuts, some that which have already are on the way, and possibly hiking taxes even further, as well as cutting down on bloated government sector spending.
And finally, Philip, it sounds like there are some things about this crisis that are unique to Sri Lanka, but in other ways, maybe not. Could this crisis possibly be a bellwether of other financial crises to come elsewhere?
Yeah, you're exactly right. I think, you know, we can see that Sri Lanka has had its own share of specific factors that have led to where it is today. But it's certainly a worthy case study or bellwether even in terms of looking at other developing and emerging market economies that are highly indebted and suffering under high inflation. You know, it's certainly a potential warning signal for financial trouble in that developing world due to slowing growth and rising interest rates.
That was Wall Street Journal South Asia correspondent Philip Wen joining us from New Delhi, India. Philip, thank you so much for the update.
Thanks very much.
And finally, goodbye complex, hard-to-remember passwords, and hello logging in with your face and fingerprints. That is the trade-off that Apple thinks some users will be willing to make when it unveils its latest software updates this fall, which will include a new type of identity authentication called passkeys. WSJ personal tech reporter Dalvin Brown says that Apple's passkeys and similar efforts from other tech giants aim to address long-standing issues with how we log into our accounts.
Passwords have always posed security problems online. So what passkeys does is bypass that entire process. On the back end, Apple will generate two keys. One is a private key that's stored on your phone, and the other is a public key on Apple's servers. What you would use is Face ID or Touch ID or a PIN number to enable Apple to connect those two keys. And since there's no passwords, there's really nothing for hackers to try to steal.
And that's What's News for Thursday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.